Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of the show. Glad to have you with us. My name is David Inge, and we're also pleased here to have in the studio with us Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's with us every season. We talk about car care. If you're having a problem, call in and tell us about the car. Give us the make and the model. Give us the best description you can, and Rick will see if he can do a little diagnosis for you and tell you how you might go about trying to figure out what's wrong and get it taken care of. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Any point here, you can start calling, and we'll take as many as we can. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
Appreciate it. One of the things I was thinking about was tires. And I guess I was thinking that when I was a kid, it seemed like a lot of people had tires for winter and tires for summer. Now, maybe there are some places in the country people still do change their tires for the winter. I don't know. Generally now, do most people drive on the same tires year-round?
As a general rule, yeah.
Is there something different about the tires now? Are they better for all-year conditions?
Yeah, they'll make an all-season tire. As a general rule, when you visually look at a tire and the tire tread, the spacing between the raised portions of the tire, in other words, the grooves. Mm-hmm. If the grooves are very, very narrow, then the snow is going to accumulate there. Generally, an all-season tire, you'll see larger spacing, so it, as the tire rotates in centrifugal force, of course, it self-cleans itself. But yeah, that's true. I still have customers that have winter tires and summer tires, but it's not very common.
Yeah, I guess part of the thing too is that there used to be studded snow tires, and I don't know if
that's
what I was saying. I didn't think there were probably any place that you could have them anymore because of the too much wear on the roadways. I guess.
Correct. Yeah, it was damaging the roads.
Yeah. Anything general you want to say about tire maintenance for the winter?
Tire inflation obviously is very important in cold weather, which we really haven't had too much of. The tire pressure will drop, and obviously as things are heated, they expand and they contract when they're cold. So you need to maintain tire pressure. Tire rotation is very important. Mm-hmm. That's, again, a visual observation, and it's also a physical measurement of the tire tread. The prominent wear occurs on the front tires.
All right. And when, if you're going to check your tire pressure, particularly at this time of the year, when do you want to do that?
You want to do that first thing in the morning before you have driven.
Oh, okay. So the cold, it's okay that it be cold when
yes.
you check it.
Yes.
Okay. How much do you know? Because the friction of the driving is going to warm up the air in the tire, so that means the pressure should go up some after you've been driving, isn't it?
Yeah. It's going to go up some. Obviously with racing, I monitor things like that. But as far as a street car, I can't imagine it's going to build more than 2 pounds.
Oh, okay. So there shouldn't be a whole lot of difference after it's been sitting all night and then after you've driven around for a little bit.
Well, it's going to take, maybe 30, 40 miles of driving to generate adequate heat. I mean, just a 5-minute drive is not going to generate much heat in a tire.
Okay. So it's okay to check it when it's cold.
Yes, that's when you should check it.
And is there much difference between is there going to be any difference between what they recommend for tire pressure in the summer and the winter?
No.
So it should be the same?
Tire pressures generally, if it's not in your owner's manual, it's typically on a driver's door jamb. It'll have tire pressure. Sometimes it's on the filler cap door for the gas tank. Yeah. And you want to use whatever the manufacturer recommends.
Okay. We have a caller here, somebody with a question in Mattoon. We'll talk with them. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a 94 Nissan Altima. And when I started it up, there was like a little tinkle, so I thought maybe a heat shield was loose. I took it in and had it checked out, and they told me that my timing chain was rattling and that it would need to be replaced and that they would have to take out the whole engine, so it costs like $1,400. And but they said, oh, you can drive another 10 or 20 or 30,000 miles on it and not have any problem. Do you agree with that?
Well, the first thing I would think, when you first start the car, you hear it and then the noise goes away.
Right.
Okay. Typically, that's an indication. What it has as you know, as you already mentioned, is a chain in there. To maintain tension on the chain, there's a tensioner, and it's oil pressure fed or it's self-contained hydraulic. Chances are what's happening is the tensioner is bleeding either internally or externally. In other words, it collapses. Mm-hmm. And then once you start the car, it's going to rattle for a little while. Typically, the rattle will go away right when the oil light goes out or a little bit after the oil pressure light goes out. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. So my first reaction is that you need a new tensioner as opposed to a whole chain.
Okay.
And I would definitely get another estimate.
Okay. They said they had to take the whole engine out. That's why.
Right. I understand.
But the tensioner, you don't have to take the whole engine out?
No.
Oh. Okay. Okay. Is it safe to drive?
I don't think it's a good idea.
You don't think it's a good idea. Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in here, talk with Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. You're having some trouble with your car, just call in and tell us about it, describe it, and Rick will suggest something for you. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Seems to me that again, when I was a kid, another thing that we did much more often was to change the oil, or maybe there again you had summer oil and winter oil. And I don't think we do that anymore either. No. We pretty much use the same oil year-round.
Yes, it's multi-grade, typically 10W30 or 5W30. And you need to use what the manufacturer recommends. It's typically on the oil filler cap. Obviously, it's also in the owner's manual. But they're multi-grade, and they cover a spectrum of temperatures. In other words, a low to high temperature. Yeah, years ago, you just used a straight weight oil, like 30 weight in the summer, and then a thinner. And as far as the numbers are concerned, the higher the number, the thicker the oil is. The lower the number, the thinner the oil is. So.
And you in those days, what, we used thinner oil
in the winter.
Winter,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I think it's going to be cold and
right.
Sluggish anyway, so you'd have to warm it up to the point where it was really going to circulate
right.
Really well. So you used the thinner oil in the wintertime and the heavier oil in the
summer.
Right. And now, is it a better product now?
Oh, so you really don't
do better, that?
Yeah, significantly uh-huh. better product. And a lot of manufacturers specifically recommend synthetic oils.
So that's one of those things that's going to be in the owner's manual on the car, what it is they think that you should be
correct.
Using. And what's the difference? Will it last longer?
The synthetic, it does last longer, yes. It's more expensive.
But you can go further between oil changes.
Right. Yeah, some manufacturers, 7,500 miles, Porsche, some of those are letting them go 15,000.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of oil in a Porsche. So.
Yeah. Well, it does kind of surprise me that it seems like some manufacturers, it used to be, I sort of thought about it as being maybe only 3,000-4,000 miles between changes. And then now there are some that would go a good... 7,000, 7,500.
Yeah, a lot of them will go 7,500.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, if you're not using synthetic for what oil costs and the benefits of changing it, I think it's wise to 3,000. Some people 3 months, 3,000 is a rule a lot of people use.
Yeah. And do you change filter every time?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, well, let's talk with somebody here in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello, Rick.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm calling about my brakes. The brake light came on and stayed on. And I think I've got reduced braking power. And someone has suggested a proportioning valve. And I'm wondering what that is and how difficult it is to replace.
Brake fluid level is okay. What kind of car is it?
It's a Cadillac 88.
Okay. We've got adequate brake fluid in both portions of the reservoir.
It did at the beginning. I haven't checked it now for a while.
Okay.
It was, say, for a week. But it has gone down some, seems like.
Right. Well, it's normal for it to go down some as the pads wear in particular.
Why would that light stay on?
Well, The proportioning valve has a switch in it. There's also the emergency brake switch. You can turn that light on also. As far as the proportioning valve, to answer your question, it regulates the brake pressure from the front of the car to the back of the car.
Okay.
And inside that proportioning valve, there's a slide or a spool valve. And it can slide either, if you look at it from the side and the switch is in the middle of this spool valve, it's kind of a tapered valve. So this proportioning valve switch has a little tab or button on it. And if the proportioning valve spool valve slides one way or the other, that will turn that light on. It could be an indication of a loss of brake fluid. Sometimes we'll do that. Just bleeding the brakes will equalize or recenter that valve.
Okay.
But it's definitely something you need to take a look at, particularly as you mentioned about the quality of the braking has changed. So I would definitely make an appointment and have someone take a look at it for you.
Hey, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you. Let's go on to Urbana. This is a caller on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm enjoying your program. Listen, I have an old, it's a 1988 Honda Accord, and I've noticed there's quite a few of these cars running around town lately. This one has developed a habit of not heating up the heater. That is to say, the temperature gauge stays on the cool side, although the engine seems to be running just fine. The slower I go, like if I'm just tooling around town, it gets to a normal operating temperature on the gauge and everything seems to be fine. But then if I go out on the highway and speed up to, you know, 60 or so, then it cools off. And it's interesting. What do you think would be causing that?
It needs a new thermostat.
A new thermostat?
Yeah, the thermostat is stuck open. So what happens, what the thermostat does is when the thermostat is closed, when the engine's cold, it circulates all the coolant through the block, through the heater core, which is like a small radiator that air blows through that then blows into the passenger compartment and produces the heat.
Mm-hmm.
With the thermostat being open, all the coolant is going through the radiator, which is significantly larger than a heater core. So, and particularly when you go on the highway and you've got the air movement through the radiator, a lot of times when a thermostat is stuck open, you can literally watch the temperature gauge go down.
Oh, definitely.
Yes. So it just needs a new thermostat.
Oh, that doesn't sound too difficult.
No.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the call. Again, we have lines open here. If you want to call in, you have a car problem, you can discuss it with our guest, Rick Karch, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller was just talking about that gauge on the dash that gives you the engine operating temperature. And this is just, on most cars, I guess, it's just a simple needle, and it's got hot on one side and cold on the other. On most cars, is normal operating temperature, should that be pretty much in the middle?
As a general rule, yes. It may be 1 to 2 needle widths toward cold from halfway. But yes, that's correct.
And on most cars, is that going to be about the same temperature, what the normal temperature is?
Well, it depends on the car and the age of the car. These new cars typically run 220 degrees Fahrenheit.
Uh-huh.
They let them run a lot warmer. What that does is it minimizes emissions.
And from a cold start, how much driving would you have to do, round figures, to get to that temperature, what it considers to be the optimal temperature?
Well, I don't know that there's a direct answer to that. Obviously, it depends on the ambient temperature when you start, but
yeah.
In the process of maybe 3 or 4 miles, you should start to see the gauge move.
Yeah. If you're doing the kind of driving where it's all short trips and maybe the car never quite gets that warm or doesn't get to that temperature and stay there, does that really do – is that either bad or good for the engine, or it doesn't really make any difference at all?
Well, it's hard on the engine. It's fuel mileage will obviously be very poor. If the engine never gets to operating temperature, the computer never allows the car to go into what's referred to as closed loop, where it actually starts to monitor and influence or change the air-fuel mixture. The other thing it's hard on is exhaust systems.
Yeah.
The exhaust, the moisture that accumulates in there, it never gets warm enough, meaning the exhaust never gets warm enough to dissipate that moisture.
And you get rust. You get into rusting out.
So, you know, short trips, like you're saying, A, you're going to have a lot of exhaust issues, holes, rust as a result, yeah. And, of course, mileage is going to be very poor.
Yeah. Okay. We have several callers now ready to go. I'm in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I actually have two problems. The first problem is the main one that I want to ask about, but I'll throw both of them at you. The first problem, I have an 87 Buick Century, and most of the time it starts fine, but once in a while I can't get it to start. And it seems to happen usually when it's damp outside, but I've taken the car in with this problem, and of course it starts fine when I take it to the garage. So I didn't know if you had any suggestions on what that might be. And then the second question is that I have to add antifreeze quite a bit. I've had the hoses tightened in my car, but there is a leak somewhere, and I have to add. So I didn't know if either of those questions you could help me out. Thanks.
Well, as far as the starting scenario is concerned, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay. The starter works. In other words, when you start the car, you can hear the engine turning over.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
And then you mentioned it's worse in damp, humid, rainy weather.
Right. I can never really predict when it's not going to start, but when it doesn't start, it does seem like it's damp outside. It doesn't have anything to do with the temperature outside. Like, it doesn't happen any more often when it's cold, but it does seem to be damp.
Well, something like this, I don't know how familiar you are with cars.
Not really.
Okay. But typically when someone comes in with the complaint that you just mentioned, one of the first things that we usually do is just take like a spray bottle that's filled with water, and you just spray the wires down. And a lot of times the water becomes a conductor, and you can see the spark occurring to ground. And a lot of times it's associated with damp, humid weather, like you mentioned. That would be one of the first things to try.
Okay.
And then when it finally does start, when it's humid out, does it run rough for a while and smooth out?
Actually, no. It seems once it started, it seems fine.
Okay. The other thing with the age of the car, I would be suspicious of is fuel pump.
Okay.
Make sure the fuel pump is functioning.
Okay.
Sometimes, depending on how astute your hearing is, if you just turn the key on but don't crank the engine,
mm-hmm.
in other words, don't activate the starter, sometimes you can hear the electric fuel pump in the back. It's a little electric motor, and it's just a little buzzing noise. It only lasts for maybe 1 to 3 seconds, and then it'll stop.
Uh-huh.
That might be something to pay attention to the next time it won't start. See if you can hear that fuel pump.
You know, I think I've actually heard that, because when it hasn't started, then I'll hear that it's like a little buzzing noise, and it'll stop after a couple seconds.
Exactly. No check engine light?
No.
Okay. Well, I guess the first thing would be to spray the wires down and see if you can actually duplicate the problem.
Okay.
And then as far as the coolant leak is concerned, is this like a 3.1, the V6?
No, just a second. It's a four-cylinder.
Four-cylinder?
Yeah.
As far as adding coolant, you obviously have a leak.
Yeah.
So what needs to be done is they need to pressure test the cooling system for several hours. It may not appear right away. Some of these leaks are kind of difficult to evaluate. Sometimes you pressure test them and you don't find anything. Then what you have to do is you have to start the car and get it up to operating temperature while it's still under pressure. Sometimes it's kind of time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
To see where the leak is. You notice anything on the ground in the garage?
Yeah. Whenever I put a little container underneath it, and then it always leaks some out.
And it's over on the passenger side?
That's correct.
Yeah. That's where the water pump is.
Okay.
And water pumps typically only leak when it's shut off.
Okay. So if something needs to be done with the water pump?
It's possible. At the bottom of the water pump where the pulley is, there's referred to as a weep hole. Mm-hmm. And if you just take a mirror and a flashlight, you can look at the bottom side of that pump, and you can actually see the coolant will leave a stain or a trail. So it's usually a visual observation of the water pump.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks for your help.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We'll keep going here, and we'll go next to talk with someone in Terre Haute, and it's line 4. It's a toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a 97 Lincoln Town Car, and I've noticed it doesn't happen all the time, but on a regular basis, when it's upshifting, usually from second to third, it'll shudder. And I was wondering, I read online somewhere I mentioned might be the torque converter, but I don't really have any clue.
Second to third, what about when it goes into overdrive? Which would be about 30.
Yeah, sometimes, yeah, at highway speeds.
No, it'll go into overdrive around 38 to 40 mile an hour right in there.
Yeah, it does that.
Okay. Typically on the town car, what it is a spark plug wires.
Really?
Yes, it's an ignition issue.
Okay. So I should have that checked out then?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're getting close here to our midpoint. Rick Karch is our guest. He's the owner of Rick's Automotive in Champaign, and he's generally here with us every season to take questions about car care, and it could be something seasonal or it just could be a problem. If you're having a problem, you're not quite sure what to do about it. If you call in and tell us about it, give us the best description that you can. He'll try and do a little diagnosis here and see if he can help you out. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL or 9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about tires. We talked about oil change. Is there anything else that's maintenance issues that are particularly cold weather issues?
Well, not particularly cold weather issues, but usually the one that comes to most people's mind, and that's the battery. Actually, more batteries fail in the summer, but batteries, 5 years. Even if it still works, after 5 years, you should just replace it.
Uh-huh.
You can have them tested, obviously. They do what's referred to as a load test, and that will evaluate the battery. Charging system, the little light on the dash that looks like a battery or alternator light. Sometimes if that glows, that means that there's a problem with the alternator. The alternator is what charges the battery. Once the engine starts and the alternator starts spinning, it starts charging the battery. But batteries, usually, most people, you just don't even think about it.
Yeah.
And that's why I usually just recommend 5 years.
Yeah, don't think about it until you go out and try to start the
car.
Well,
that's the problem.
It doesn't go.
It's always at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And for the cost of a battery versus the cost of towing, the inconvenience, and the fact that they may not be able to deal with it immediately, it's one of those scenarios where you want it fixed yesterday, and sometimes it doesn't work out that way.
Yeah, okay.
So it's kind of a maintenance item.
So and it's funny because, as you say, you think of a dead battery as being a winter problem, but you said actually more batteries fail in the summer?
Summer, yes.
Because of the heat?
Yes.
Okay, well, if your battery's more than 5 years old, go out and get a new one. I've got somebody here on a cell phone, line 1. Hello.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling kind of a more general question. Well, two questions. First of all, I have a 1989 Toyota Corolla, so she's pretty old. And I need to have a tie rod, a back tie rod replaced. And I'm wondering, as far as that goes, whether one can get a used part, like from the parts recycling folks, for that kind of a repair, or if you really need to just go with a new part.
New part.
A new part?
Yes. I consider that a safety item.
Yeah.
A tie rod end is part of the steering.
Yeah. And so then the other question becomes, okay, so it's an 89. She's got over 200 and bazillion miles on her. And the tie rod repair will be, you know, $250. And then there's also a strut. And they were saying, you know, the struts, you have to replace them in pairs. If I got all of that kind of stuff done, they were saying it might be around $1,000. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do you know when it's time to get another car? because she's been really great. I've gotten a lot of use out of this car, and I know that Toyotas have a really great record for lasting a long time. Over the years, the main expenses have been things that were, first of all, I may have been getting ripped off, but second of all, exhaust kinds of things. And those, I know, kind of just happen through use of the car and that kind of thing. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, as far as cost-wise, when it becomes, I've put enough money into this car and it's time to get a new one. So I wondered if you had any advice about that kind of thing.
Well, that's a real hard question to answer. I mean, you have to kind of think about how much you've spent over the years, how many miles you've driven it, and if you write everything down on paper and you get all your receipts out, you may find that you really haven't spent very much money.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a tie rod end is concerned, with that kind of mileage, that's just going to happen. I mean, they wear out. As far as the struts or shocks are concerned, typically Toyotas are pretty good on that, meaning when shocks are bad, when you're driving the vehicle, if you hit a pothole or something, sometimes you'll hear a real loud thud or thunk noise. In other words, the shock just literally bottoms out.
Yeah.
The other thing you'll notice with shocks is they deteriorate is that after you hit dips in the road at highway speeds, the car will keep bouncing.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any of those two?
I don't, but when I took it into two different places, and both of them said that there was stuff leaking.
It's leaking. Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. And again, you know, with that kind of mileage, that's not unusual.
Plus, I have to admit that I'm not, you know, the most wonderful driver, and I have done things like run over curbs.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see if I had myself, like, just knocked the darn thing or something.
Well, that can fatigue them a little sooner, yes.
Yeah.
So I think if you just sit to try to answer your question, if you just get all your receipts and kind of formulate and, I mean, has it been a car that you've had to put a transmission in or anything major like that?
No, I haven't had to put a transmission in. I've had the starter replaced, but I got a used one. Mm-hmm. I feel like the repairs have been very reasonable. Over the years, they may have added up, but I got the car for $5,400 in the first place, so it's definitely been a good purchase.
Well, yeah, then you've got your money's worth then.
Yes, I sure have. I'll look over the receipts and see what I think, but I appreciate your input.
Okay, you're welcome.
Well, thanks for the call. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, generally, what do you think about using used parts in repairs?
Well, kind of like I mentioned to her, I'm not comfortable personally installing used parts on a car if they're safety related. Steering, suspension, brakes. I just think there's too much risk involved to do that. As far as, used engines, transmissions, because the costs, you know, it may be half or less of what a new one would cost. And in a used car, you sometimes, it's just not worth buying new for those major components like that. Trim pieces, seats, interior pieces, things like that, used or fine. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to Eureka, line 4. Another caller right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a 95 Avalon, and the right rear brake caliper does not release. It drags somewhat.
Okay. Well, it's one of three things. The slider maybe frozen or stuck.
Okay.
The piston itself in the caliper may be frozen.
Okay.
And or the hose may be collapsed.
Okay. I'll have to check those three things.
Yeah, it's kind of a process of pull the caliper off, take the pads out, make sure everything slides okay first.
Okay.
Then try to move the piston back into the caliper. If it doesn't move, if you loosen the bleeder valve and then it does move, then it needs a new hose.
Okay.
If it still doesn't move, it needs a caliper.
Okay. Another question. On this vehicle, the anti-lock brake system device died. Have you ever replaced that motor and that whole package?
With used units, and those things are very expensive.
Very expensive. Yeah. Well, I just disconnected it and been driving it that way.
Well, you understand what ABS is,
right? Okay. I know.
Okay, so it's
if I pump the brakes, I can get the same, probably the same effect.
Well, I guess the reason I mention it is that the normal brake system will still function.
Right. Exactly. Right. I haven't lost any braking.
Okay.
It just lock up.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Bye.
Well, is that a safety issue? As long as your brakes are functioning, if the automatic braking system is not doing what it does, would you be okay driving a car like that?
Me or
well, okay, you would you if your it was your car, would you drive that car
with
No, you wouldn't.
No. Okay. That's a safety issue. And for what anti-lock brakes mean is, or ABS, is that if it's, for example, if it's raining or if you're in snow or gravel and you have to stop and you push down on the brake pedal as hard as you can, and for those of you that have a car that has ABS, maybe we should back up. When you first get in your car, if you just turn the key on and don't start the car and look at all the lights on the dash and one of them says ABS, anti-lock brake system. Mm-hmm. Your car has anti-lock brake system. And you need to go into a parking lot when it's raining or it's slippery for whatever reason, where there's no traffic around, and step on the brake pedal as hard as you can so that you know what it feels like. Because the first time it happens, if you're not familiar with it, it's like somebody is tapping or hitting the bottom of your foot. The brake pedal actually moves, and you'll also hear a chattery type noise. Mm-hmm. That's normal. That means the system is functioning. And the last thing you want to do in that scenario is to release the brake pedal. You want to keep your foot down.
Okay.
And so what's happening when the pedal is pulsating like that is that one wheel, or more than one, is locking up. And what happens is the computer monitors each of the wheels, and when it sees no rotation, it will release pressure to that wheel and allow it to rotate. And then when it locks up again, it'll just keep doing that with solenoid valves electrically. So that the advantage to anti-lock brakes is that when this is happening, and if you turn the steering wheel, you can still turn the vehicle. Because if the wheels aren't rotating, if you turn the wheel, you're just going to keep going the direction you were going in. So that's the advantage of anti-lock brakes.
Yeah. And this is, it's the old thing about how you were taught if the car starts to skid, you're supposed to pump
the brakes. Pedal.
This is what it's doing, although it's doing it faster than you could. And if the problem was only with one wheel, then it will just do the one wheel that's locking up instead of...
All of them.
All of them.
Yes,
yeah.
That's correct.
Okay. So generally, has that been a good... Now, I think there are probably more and more cars that have that on there.
It's
has that generally been
a good
thing as far as safety is concerned?
Oh, I think it's... tremendous thing, particularly with pickup trucks. You know, the weight bias in a pickup truck is just miserable. I mean, there's really not much weight in the back if you've ever driven a pickup truck. And anti-lock brakes on a truck are just, it's a tremendous advantage.
You just get some concrete blocks and put them in the back.
Well, it takes a lot of blocks.
Oh, okay. Okay, let's talk with somebody on cell phone here. Line one. Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, my question is kind of a maintenance thing about the transmission. I have a 2002 Toyota Camry, no problems, no maintenance problems at all, 60,000 miles, and I've had two schools of thought on changing the transmission fluid. Some say once it gets that many miles, just go and don't worry about it. And I've been thinking about changing the whole fluid and filter and screen or whatever, and just wanted to know what you think about transmission maintenance. Preventive.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's preventive type of maintenance. I haven't had a problem. Should I go ahead and do this or not?
Well, at 60,000, I don't see an issue. If you were at 90,000 or close to 100, I wouldn't recommend it. In your owner's manual, a lot of times they'll list that. It'll be listed as additional services and depending upon driving conditions, driving habits. But, yeah, it'll be listed in your book, yes, if you look in the maintenance section of it.
No, I haven't looked at all. That's
right. If you look through there, you'll see it in there.
Okay, but if it recommends like a 35, should you still go ahead and do it at 60?
Yes, you'll be fine.
Okay, thank you for your information.
All right, thanks for the call. I think this is something that has come up before, and your advice was when you have this car that's got a lot of miles on it, you probably don't want to do
that. When they get close to 100, if it's never been serviced, I'm always kind of leery about it because when we talk about service the transmission, we mean we're going to drain all the fluid out. If it has a pan, we're going to remove the pan at the bottom of the transmission, and then inside that pan there's a filter, and we're going to replace that filter, and then we're going to put everything back together and dump some more fluid in it. Mm-hmm. Well, if it's gone 100,000 miles and it's never been serviced, the buildup or small little material that's accumulated in the bottom of the pan within the transmission, anytime you take something apart, you potential is that you're going to disrupt or move some little piece of dirt, and the transmission operates on very, very small openings and passageways. And sometimes when you service a transmission with over 100,000 miles on it, I kind of look at it as it's like flipping a coin. Either it's going to be okay or it's not going to be okay because you've disrupted something and created a problem. So that's just kind of my take on it.
So then you would get into a situation where then the car wouldn't shift properly?
Wouldn't shift properly, and the transmission typically would have to be either rebuilt or replaced.
And that could be pretty expensive.
That's anywhere from $1,500 to $2,000, depending on the car.
Mm, okay. So better leave it alone if you got that kind of mileage. If it's never been done.
Yeah, and if it's working okay. I mean, if it's not working okay, then you really don't have a whole lot to lose.
Yeah.
You can try new fluid and see if it helps. There are a lot of additives you can put in transmissions, too.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else. Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hey, I have some questions about diesel engines. Do you have expertise with those?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I have an old Kubota tractor and an international engine. And then a Ford truck that probably has a Cummins in it. Well, they were all sort of abandoned, and one of them hasn't been started for like 4 years, and then one I started a couple of months ago. And the little tractor will be probably 3 years not running at all, just abandoned. When they were all, I mean, they all ran pretty well when they were being used.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm thinking I'll start charging up the batteries and see if I can get them going again. Is there anything I should do? Like, I don't. I was just going to go out there and turn the key and see what happens.
Well, if it's been sitting that long, it's been like sitting outside.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they're in a shed, but it's open to the outside. So.
Well, particularly with a diesel, before you even start it, the first thing is they're probably both going to need new batteries. If they sat that long, I would drain the fuel out of the tanks and get fresh fuel in there and put new fuel filters on it and change the oil before you start them. And then if you have difficulty starting them, then you may have to take the injectors out and have them cleaned and tested. Mm-hmm. Because it's a pintle valve. In other words, it's an inward opening nozzle. And they may be stuck in a closed position. So that would probably be the worst-case scenario.
Oh, okay. All righty. Well, I'll try to do that before I get too excited and run out. The weather's been so nice. I was thinking it was going to be so cold over the winter. I'd forget about it until...
It's supposed to be nice this week.
Yeah, I know. I'm tempted.
Yeah, there you go.
I think I'll wait. Well, thanks.
Sure. All right, thanks for the call. To someone here on the campus, line one. Hello.
Hey there. How are you doing?
Good.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Thanks.
I'm driving a 99 Toyota Tacoma pickup V6, and the engine has started surging of late, especially when it's cold. Any idea what I can do cheaply to get it to stop doing that?
This is just first thing in the morning?
As a general rule, mm-hmm. only first thing in the morning.
Does it idle higher than you remember?
No, I got a tack on it, and it seems to be idling pretty much at the normal speed.
Like 1,200?
Yeah, 12, 14, something
uh-huh.
in there.
And when we refer to surge, we're saying that as we watch the needle,
the
needle
RPM
goes
needle
up, go down,
right.
up and down.
And it, of course, I can hear it as well.
No check engine light?
No.
Has anything been done to the engine as far as idle adjustments?
Probably not. Its most recent service was about 7,000, 8,000 miles ago. It's got 96K on it right mm-hmm. now, which means it's about half broken in since it's a Toyota.
Right. And so this just started recently? It wasn't after that prior service?
It started within the last month, and the service was about a year ago.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of times when they surge, it's one of two things. Either the fuel delivery is changing.
Right.
In other words, it gets too much fuel, the RPM goes up. It gets less fuel, the RPM goes down. Or there could be a vacuum leak. Does it make a difference if it's in reverse or drive?
It's manual, so it's sitting there.
Okay. So you can't.
Neutral.
Okay. But it's one of those two things. As far as vacuum leaks are concerned, if you raise the hood and just listen,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times you can hear that.
Yeah, my 88 has a vacuum leak and the check engine light comes on.
Mm-hmm. But those would be the two things I would be looking at.
Okay, so a vacuum leak, and the other one was maybe a plugged fuel filter or something?
Well, fuel filter, when it's restricted, generally creates a loss or lack of power.
Okay.
And fuel filters, when you first start the car, a fuel filter's not going to create an issue unless it's really restricted.
All righty, so I guess I better get my stethoscope out. And start.
How old is the fuel filter?
It's probably original. I don't think that they replaced it in the most recent service, or perhaps it was replaced at the 60,000 miles.
Yeah, you might look through your receipts and see if it has been replaced. That's another area that could create what you're referring to.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll check those two things out.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. If you're having car troubles here, call in and tell us about it. He'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Philo, line 2. Hello.
Yes, I have a quick question about in 1990. I had a 1986 Buick that I was having it, the oil changed at a fast lube place, and they recommended flushing it out with some kind of solvent, then putting in new oil. Short time after that, I had engine problems and had to replace the engine. Is that still recommended, or is that a bad thing to do, to flush the engine out with the solvent and then put in new oil?
Well, when you say solvent, we're just talking about like a quart of additive?
No, they actually recommended. It was, I won't mention any names, quick lube joint, and I was not having a problem at all. They came in and they recommended, said the oil was dirty, that they recommended putting this solvent in without any oil, just running that solvent through the oil the system for a few minutes or however long, draining that back out and then putting in new oil.
So that, make sure I understand this. So they drain the oil.
Yes.
They put
this is my understanding. They drained the oil and put this solvent, some kind of solvent, in place of the oil, ran the engine for a period of time, I don't know how long, drained it back out, and then refilled with new oil.
So they put like 4 or 5 quarts of this solvent in?
I assume. This has been about 10 years.
Okay.
This happened back about 1990.
Okay. Well, no. First of all, the solvent is not going to protect the engine and the bearings if you run it with solvent. That's like putting water in there.
Well, I assume that they didn't, you know, but maybe they may have only run it at maybe just with a starter. I don't know.
Well,
I should have looked into it more at the time,
sure.
And I wasn't. I thought it was at a trustworthy place. And
but as far as additives are concerned, they do make additives where if things are extremely dirty or sludge, but when they get that bad, that stuff's not going to work.
Okay.
I mean, the only way you're going to get it out of there is to take the valve covers off and physically scrape and vacuum and scrape and vacuum to get it out of there.
Well, that's kind of what I thought. I got took. It was my own fault.
But
I just wanted to hear what your opinion was.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We'll go to Urbana here, line number one. That's our next person. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. I have a 95 Chrysler LeBaron, and like a lot of Chrysler's, transmission problems. When I start the car, particularly if it's cooler than about 60 degrees outside, it takes a while for it to engage in first or reverse. And I find that it's easier if I gun the car to get it to get into gear. Am I damaging my car when I do that?
Yeah, it's not helping matters. I get the first thing I would look at would be the fluid level.
Okay.
The transmission fluid level. There'll be a dipstick under the hood.
Okay.
And you want to check that fluid level on the dipstick. So you're going to pull the dipstick out and wipe it off. And if you look at the dipstick, there'll be a mark. It'll say cold. And
right.
Then higher up on the dipstick or closer to the handle part of it, there'll be another mark for hot.
Okay.
So when you start at cold, the transmission fluid level should be at the cold mark, and as it warms up and expands, the level will rise, and then it will be at the warm mark. What you're saying to me sounds like it's a quart low, or maybe a quart and a half low on fluid.
Okay.
And until the fluid expands, and that's when, once the car is warm, everything seems okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably...
It only is a problem if I stop too hard, then the car will die sometimes, but that might be completely unrelated.
Yeah, is that only after going like 40 mile an hour?
Well, the problem is it's around town, and sometimes you never get up to that.
Oh, okay. Well, that may be
usually after I drive it on the highway for a while, the car acts completely normally.
Okay, that's more than likely. If you're never getting above 35 mile an hour, that dying when you come to a stop is probably not related to the transmission.
Okay.
But I would check the fluid level.
Okay, great. That's easy.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to line three. This is also someone in Urbana. Line three, hello.
Hello. I have a 2001 Subaru Forester, and in the morning, when it's cold outside, it has what sounds like a piston slapping in it. Is this a major job to replace it, or do you think you just let it go and not worry about it?
So this is like a double knock?
I don't know if you'd call it a double knock. It just does it for about, maybe 4 or 5 minutes when you're driving it too, especially on your load as well.
And then it does go away?
Then it goes away.
Okay. More than likely, you're probably correct. As the piston expands, in other words, skirt to cylinder wall clearance thereby decreases. It's kind of a hard noise to describe. It's not metallic, and it's not like a dull thud type noise. It's kind of in between there.
That's what it is.
Okay. Yeah.
And once again, it's a wintertime problem more than a summertime one.
Yes.
And is this an expensive problem to fix, or do you worry about it?
Yes, it is expensive, because basically you're talking about A, rebuild the engine, or B, replace it.
Okay.
So.
And will it just function okay if you don't mind the noise in the morning?
It should, yes.
Okay. So just don't worry about it then.
Well, I mean, obviously if the noise changes, then you need to address it.
It's been getting worse over time, but it's been probably a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And you're probably the only one that hears it because you are tuned into it.
True.
So,
okay. Very good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right. Thanks for the call. Somebody wants to call real quick here. I'm sure we can get in one more. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have talked about some general maintenance issues. Is there anything in particular that you either we haven't talked about or you just would like to emphasize again that are either general or that have actually to do with cold weather? And we talked about tires, we talked about battery, talked about well, read your owner's manual and make sure you're getting your oil changed at the appropriate intervals.
Yeah, you definitely need to open that up at least once in a while and look at that. I guess the other thing I should mention about lights, particularly taillights, license plate lights, believe it or not, is I think a $75 ticket now if you have no license plate lights.
Yes. Really? Okay.
So, and walk around your car every once in a while. It seems like when tire pressure, we've talked about that and you've asked about tire pressure. Yeah. It always seems to me when there's a tire pressure issue, meaning a tire is extremely low, it's always the right rear. You just never walk around the car in terms of the right rear. If it was the left rear or the left front or one of the front tires, you would notice it because it's going to either pull or drift to the one direction or the other, which tire is lower. So so I'd say lights, wiper blades, make sure the coolant is properly protected. That, again, is a maintenance item. Just if you follow the owner's manual, the scheduled maintenance services, you should be fine.
Yeah.
And in the long run, it is cheaper to do the maintenance than it is to fix by crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sound advice. Okay. So check and see what's in there. Follow the recommendations. Take a look at your tires. Walk all the way around the car. Make sure the lights are working. Check and make sure your washer fluid, you got plenty of that. You probably want to have some of that this time of year. Okay. Well, I guess at that we could finish up and say thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Rick Karch from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. He's generally here every season to take questions on car care.